We've met before, haven't we?
I don't think so. Where was it you think we met?
At your house. Don't you remember?
No. No, I don't. Are you sure?
Of course. As a matter of fact, I'm there right now.
What do you mean you're where right now?
At your house.
That's fucking crazy, man.
Call me. Dial your number. Go ahead. I told you I was here.
How did you do that?
Ask me.
How did you get inside my house?
You invited me. It's not my custom to go where I am not wanted.
Who are you?
Give me back my phone. It's been a pleasure talking to you. So tonight we're talking about disembodied voices.
We're transmitting this from the year 1999. This is the Lament Configuration Podcast. I'm Julia Graffaire. I'm a graphic novelist, and that's all. And with me is the mystery woman,
Gretchen Felker-Martin, film critic and horror author.
I'm glad you decided you wanted to be the mystery man because you're a much better actor than I am, I think.
I don't know about that. I mean, like, I think my voice has a broader range than yours.
Okay. We can call it that if you want.
All right.
Somebody came to a reading of mine one time and said that he said it in like a weird passive aggressive way, or maybe he was just had no idea he was being weird, but he was like, how come you do all your characters really monotone like that?
What an asshole. It's like,
well, give me back my phone.
So that bit that we just did was from Lost Highway.
Now, when I was editing our episode and we were talking about disembodied voices last week, and I was like, oh, my two favorite things from, and I didn't think of this scene, which is like maybe my favorite scene from any movie ever. And I was like, I was having that thing where you are like screaming at the podcast, you know, I'm like, and David Lynch has a lot of great disembodied voices.
Yes, he does.
So we're going to talk about a lot of those, I think. Gretchen, do you want to give the context for this little scene that we just acted out?
Yeah, sure. So in this scene, Fred, the movie's protagonist, is at a party. Right. Brought to you by Julia.
I'm Fred.
When the mystery man, me, walks in and tells Fred that he thinks he knows him. And then they have this exchange where Fred calls his own house and the mystery man answers the phone. And then he talks to both iterations of the mystery man simultaneously. And I mean, you're right. This is one of the best scenes in anything ever. It's so incredible. It's like the part in Cronenberg's Naked Lunch where Ian Holm is talking and his voice just fades out. And then he starts talking directly into the protagonist's mind.
Mm-hmm.
But much, much better and richer and more ambiguous. I mean, when there's a voice without an origin, a voice that you can't place, I feel like it has many, many, many associations for people. Ghosts, all manner of haunts and spooks and things. And then God, too,
mm-hmm.
is often depicted as a voice without a body.
So this Lost Highway scene has like a particular resonance for me, I think, because like a lot of people of our generation, I'm terrified of the phone. No, but I had a book when I was a kid, like one of those book fair books that you just end up with, called Phone Call from a Ghost. And it was, I think it was probably just a collection of urban legends, because I've seen a lot of these stories or similar ones printed elsewhere. But, you know, there was the one, and I have used pieces from this in many of my comics, I think, because it stuck with me so much. But there's, I think the first story in it, the one that gave the book its title, is about this couple whose son is like living far away. And he calls them in the middle of the night and says, Mom, Dad, I'm scared. I don't know where I am. I'm cold.
Right.
And then the next day they find out that he had died hours before they got the phone call.
That's the kind of phone call you never want to get.
Yeah, it's to be avoided if possible. You hate to see it.
Dead son phone call.
That scared the bejesus out of me. It still does. It still gives me a chill telling you about it. And that comic that I talked about last week, River of Tears, borrows some elements from that. I think that probably Alex says, "I'm so cold."
Yeah.
But there's also a scene in my comic, Black is the Color, where the protagonist, Warren, I'm going to spoil my book, catch up, I guess. The protagonist dies. And at the moment of his death, his wife back on land, because he's a sailor, has an encounter with his ghost, who shows up like soaking wet with salt water and unable to speak.
Yeah.
And then in the morning, he's gone. She has no way of knowing that he has died. But that scene was inspired by the phone call from a ghost.
It's a fantastic scene. I mean,
thank you. A lot of people are really thrown by it. I think it's similar to the kind of cold open scene at the beginning of Laid Waste, where Agnes's mother has the conversation with death. At least when I see people talking about these books or reviewing them, sometimes like those two scenes, they get kind of hung up on. They're like, I couldn't really tell what this was about, or these were like characters that were not connected to the main plot. A lot of people think that the Agnes's mother is Agnes, even though that's clearly the name of the baby.
It is very clear. That one I don't get at all. Like,
yeah,
could not be more straightforward.
Thank you. I think so too. The scene with Warren, I can see, is a little confusing because you have not seen his wife up until this point.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are conditioned to look for an answer or an explanation, and that's not really like the spirit in which I like to receive your work.
Thank you. You do receive it. Yeah, I think that you don't really need to know the whole backstory there to appreciate what is happening, which I'm really not trying to be cute. Honest to God, this is a thing that I really value about David Lynch, is that it's not necessarily rewarding to pick everything to death and figure out how it all fits together.
No, it's
like
not.
It moves in a much more intuitive way.
Yeah. I've said before that with Lynch, it is a sensual experience as much or maybe more than it's a narrative one.
Mm-hmm. So you kind of just take it all in at face value as much as you can and feel your way through it rather than try to outsmart it.
Exactly. I think a lot of people have problems doing that.
So I'm sorry that this is the second podcast that I'm opening up by saying this to you, but so you had a viral tweet.
Oh, God.
And it ruined your life again.
Oh, every fucking time.
Stop being so insightful and this won't happen. Gretchen made a really good tweet about Twin Peaks and how it's... I'm not going to try and say it.
The tweet was that Twin Peaks is a show which perfectly demonstrates how to make a murder mystery about the victim.
There you go.
And I also said that subsequent television shows, which have drawn a lot from Twin Peaks, have really overlooked or just willfully ignored that. Mm-hmm. Because Twin Peaks really is like, takes place entirely within the negative space of Laura's life. There's nothing in it that she didn't touch or that doesn't tell us something about her.
Yes. And as usual, you're absolutely correct.
Thank you, my dear.
And for the most part, I think the tweet went viral because many people agreed with you. Or as is the case with so much good writing, you put into words something that they had felt but been unable to say. Because so many people, because I looked at all the quote retweets just to make sure nobody was picking on you. So many of them were saying like, yes, I have felt this, but I didn't know how to articulate it. So
it's one of my
job.
Favorite things to see. It feels so satisfying to be like, oh shit, I like cracked that seal for someone. Also, I just love to get the notifications that you just went feet first into the mansion.
I just go through and like all your you are such a little cunt. Like you really could just log off. You don't have to reply to every but I love that you do.
I just feel like if someone is gonna tell me like, yeah, you know, Firewalk With Me really expands on this a lot. Mm-hmm. There's no way I'm not going to be like, wow, I should watch it.
Yeah, it has to be said. I liked the guy who said, was it the one who said that that Coop was the real killer?
Oh my God.
And you just said no.
Yeah.
And he like posted a link to a blog. So I posted the link to the dictionary definition of no.
Yep. That was a very good one.
Thank you.
Yeah, he was referencing fucking Heather Hogan, who is a critic whose work I deeply and profoundly do not agree with and have basically no respect for.
Oh, the guy who said that Twin Peaks was angry at Laura Palmer for not being a perfect version.
I'm conflating two guys, different types of guy. There was another guy who said that actually Twin Peaks was about how Laura Palmer was a slut, so she got what she deserved, and that's what Twin Peaks was about.
And then when 50 people yelled at him, he was like, well, I don't know why you're all mad at me. I'm just repeating what some other idiot said.
Right. Like, wow.
That doesn't make it better.
When has that ever gone badly for anyone?
No. Anyway, we had a good time online. But I think that Twin Peaks also is in the same vein of a story where you get messages from a ghost.
Absolutely. You know? Especially in The Return. But even in the original, I mean, when you think about the log, which is such a famous pop culture object.
Yes.
The log lady's log that she carries around. We know that it's talking, but we never hear it.
Ooh.
It's like it's an embodied non-voice.
Oh, I never thought about that. Mulholland Drive has another, maybe the other best disembodied voice scene, which is Club Silencio.
Yeah. That singer is performing. I know the song's translation is My Tears.
Oh, yeah, it's Crying by Roy Orbison. Crying
right.
Over you. That's Rebecca Del Rio.
And she collapses mid-performance and is dragged off the stage, but the performance continues without her.
The protagonists have been invited to a secret club where the entertainment is just continually collapsing or stopping, and the sound continues without them. And it turns out to be a clue to the nature of the story. There's another disembodied voice, too, in Mulholland Drive that I find really haunting, which is when she calls her own apartment and listens to her own voicemail message.
Oh, yeah, I had forgotten about that.
Yeah, it's Betty trying to help Rita find out who she is. And they get this address. And it's Diane Selwyn's address. And they're like, oh, maybe you're Diane Selwyn. So they call it and they just get the voicemail. So they go there. They break into her apartment, which is actually Betty's apartment in her other life where she's Diane Selwyn. And she finds her own dead body in the apartment.
Right.
And then the reality of the movie shout is incredible. So this voice of the voicemail message is penetrating between from one reality to another. This is, I think, maybe the crux of the disembodied voice for me, is that it moves between worlds in a way that other types of information can't. Like, to me, a radio is very spooky because it's, you know, literally voices carried on the ether. They can be coming from anywhere.
I was going to say, you see that borne out in horror. Radios are frequent devices for frightening background in ways that televisions are used much more seldom. Seldomly. And I think that's a good explanation why the radio is sort of inherently more frightening.
Yeah. When I was talking to Sean about this subject a little bit, I was telling him that to me, one of the scariest parts of The Shining, the book, is when Jack is in the basement reading the archives of the Overlook and the radio starts talking to him in his father's voice.
Yeah.
Do you remember this? It says this is the Happy Jack channel.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Oh my God. If a radio started talking to me, I would die. Actually, I had an experience similar to that. Where,
really?
Well, it's not really spooky like that, but I was listening to, I forget if it was a radio program or a podcast, but they were talking about me, which is why I was listening to it. And then at some point they started talking to me.
Ah.
They were like, Julia, if you're listening, can you let us know, why did you do this? What does this mean? And I'm like, They're not supposed to know that I'm listening.
God, that really breaches the contract that is listening to the radio.
Yeah, really freaked me out. Number stations, I think, are also literally the scariest form of radio that there is.
Number stations really scare me.
Yeah, I'm going to explain that because not everybody knows what a number station is. It's a radio station of unknown origin that plays coded messages, presumably for spies that are out in the field. And this is a way for them to get information. They can pick it up with a shortwave radio if they're listening at a certain time on a certain channel. And it's not that suspicious to have a shortwave radio. They can decode the message with a one-time pad, which is a single-use code key, and then dispose of it. And it's a message that has no physical substance. But you can listen to these. And now there are not very many of them left. This is more of a Cold War phenomenon. But you can listen to recordings of them. There's a really famous collection of them called the Conet Project. So you can listen to recordings of them, and they're terrifying. Normally, there's kind of a station ID that goes on for a bit, which can be a series of numbers or a little segment of music, or it can be a word or two. Somebody, like, there's one where they say, "Atención, atención." They'll do that for a couple of minutes, and then they'll read a series of numbers. And usually it's a computer voice or a somehow simulated or recorded voice. It's not somebody reading out loud because it has to be as anonymous as possible. Sometimes it's right, a child's voice. Usually it's a woman's voice, and not necessarily in English, although often in English, because if you are broadcasting in your language of your country of origin, then that gives people who are listening a clue to who you are that you might not want to leave them. So then they just say, like, 25... 3, 19, 4. They'll say a string of maybe 50 or 60 numbers, and then there'll be a pause and they'll repeat it for a couple of hours. So it's both incredibly boring and incredibly unnerving. A simulated voice is also very upsetting.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, all over the world, in cultures of varying ancientness and even into the modern day, breath, the voice, is something with a lot of power.
Mm-hmm.
And to throw that across the world via a phone or a radio, or to manufacture it via an artificial voice, these are, like, profoundly unsettling actions.
Yeah, it's really uncanny in the literal sense that it feels like something that shouldn't exist.
Right. It's something that resists understanding.
Yeah.
So... back to Silencio.
Yes.
And the club in Mulholland Drive. I feel like that really is sort of a keystone to what the movie's all about.
Do you want to go over the plot of the movie real quick?
I know the basics, but I think you have a better, like, procedural understanding of what quote-unquote happens in Mulholland Drive.
I've given it a lot of thought.
I would consider you an expert.
Thanks. It's been probably about a year since the last time I watched it, so apologies if I mess anything up. But the broad strokes are that the movie is in two halves, and in the first half, the main character is a young woman, very pretty, blonde, kind of preppy, just real Pollyanna idealism, coming off a plane for the first time and arriving in Hollywood because she wants to become an actress. And she's going to stay at her aunt's place while her aunt is out of town because her aunt works in show business and she's working on a movie. And while she's there, she's going to do some auditions and try and get discovered. And everywhere she goes, people are just happy to meet her and want to help her out. And it's a very, you know, it's the side of David Lynch that's, like, kind of corny white picket fence.
Right. Boy Scout stuff.
Yeah. And then she meets a mysterious woman who is hiding in the apartment, who she at first believes must be a friend of her aunt's. But then she finds out this woman has amnesia. She was in an accident. She doesn't know who she is, but she's scared. And so Betty pluckily decides that she's going to help her solve this mystery. So the young blonde actress, her name is Betty, and the mystery woman is Rita, which she calls herself that because she sees a Rita Haywood poster. She doesn't remember her name. So they have these kind of adventures together, trying to figure this out. Like I said, they make this phone call. they figure out that there was a car accident on Mulholland Drive the night that Rita remembers something happening to her, maybe being in an accident. They're like, oh, that must have been you. They become very emotionally close. And, oh, Betty goes on an audition and she's like a revelation. Everybody's like, oh, she's amazing. They take her to see a director who's casting a star for a film called The Sylvia North Story. And you can tell from the way that they've set it up that she is perfect for this role, but he is unable to give it to her.
Right, because he's under pressure to say yes to another woman.
A mobster's girlfriend that he's like, yeah, he's basically being forced to. So they have this one moment where they meet, and then Betty has to run home. They go to Diane's apartment, which they think is maybe Rita's apartment, and they discover this corpse. And then they come back to Betty's aunt's place, and they make love. Then they fall asleep, but then they wake up and realize they have to go to this place, this Club Silencio. So they take a cab there. They have this experience where they sit in the audience of this tiny, weird club where the MC is like doing this whole spiel, like, no, I banda, there is no band, and yet we hear a band, you know, and he's like,
right,
doing little magic tricks, or doing the gestures of magic tricks and setting off different noises and things. And even though he keeps saying this is false, like, then they bring out like a trumpet player, and you see the trumpet player playing, and then in the middle of his playing, he puts down his trumpet and the music continues. And then you see Rebecca Del Rio singing this incredibly moving song, just really emotional, really intense. And Betty and Rita are both weeping, listening to this and shaking all over. And then the singer collapses. And again, the music continues. And every time you fall for it, like every time you're like, oh, okay, this is the real music. No. And this is the divider between the two sections of the movie. Okay, so after they visited the club, then same characters. They have different names and it's much more realistic, not idealized. And so now Rita's name is Camilla and Betty's name is Diane. And they're both actresses who had been in love and they've broken up at the time of the story happening. At the time that we enter into their story. And we see a little bit of their recent history where Camilla is, she falls in love with this director, the same director who was unable to cast Betty. Camilla invites Diane to a party at his house on Mulholland Drive where they announce their engagement. And then Diane kills herself. That's my 5-minute synopsis of Mulholland Drive. I hope it was only 5 minutes. There's other little side stories that are woven in here and there, like with the director. You see him like getting blackmailed by a weird cowboy with no eyebrows, and there's this gangster. There's this thing,
the conversation at Winky's Diner.
Yeah, we could talk about the man behind the Winkies. That's pretty famous. Yeah. Do you want to talk about the man behind the Winkies? I feel like I've been talking a long time.
I mean, it's certainly one of the best scares there is, because they just, I mean, it's Patrick Fischler, who's a wonderful actor. He has a great, very expressive face, big eyes, big mouth. And he's talking about this terrible dream that he had about the restaurant that he is now sitting in with his friend, and how out behind it, there is a face. And in his dream, he met that face and saw it, and it terrified him down to his core. And he had to come to see if it's real. And this conversation is so serious and so grave and so emotional that it just like hovers right on the edge of hysteria, even though it's pretty low key all in all. And I feel like the whole premise of the scare, because when they go out, the face is there and Fischler's character collapses. The whole premise of the scare is
collapses like the Club Silencio people.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, that's shit. True.
And it's for even a similar reason, like a thing that is supposed to be internal and contained has come out of him and become disembodied. His dream is real.
Do you want to read the dialogue from this scene? I'm going to send it to you.
Isn't it pretty long?
No.
All right, why not?
Here, I'm just going to copy and paste it into the window.
All right. Okay, let's read it.
Okay. I just wanted to come here.
To Winkies?
This Winkies.
Okay. Why this Winkies?
It's kind of embarrassing.
Go ahead.
I had a dream about this place.
Oh boy.
See what I mean?
Okay. So you had a dream about this place. Tell me.
Well, it's the second one I've had, but they're both the same. They start out that I'm here, but it's not day or night. It's kind of half night, you know? But it looks just like this, except for the light. And I'm scared, like I can't tell you. Of all people, you're standing right over there by that counter. You're in both dreams, and you're scared. I get even more frightened when I see how afraid you are. And then I realize what it is. There's a man in the back of this place. He's the one who's doing it. I can see him through the wall. I can see his face. I hope that I never see that face ever outside of a dream. That's it.
So you came to see if he's out there?
To get rid of this god-awful feeling.
Right, then.
And then they go. And they go behind the Winkies, and sure enough, that fucking face is there, and it's awful.
There's an interesting detail in that dream, which is that he becomes even more afraid upon seeing his friend.
I love that.
Me too. And, you know, there's the surface level interpretation that if someone you think of as safe is afraid, then you're more likely to be afraid. But it's also a breach. His friend is showing up in his dream and having this access to his fear.
Mm-hmm. His friend is kind of the psychopomp in the dream, you know?
Right. You know, he's inducting him into this world of terror.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't know, a psychopomp is a guide to the land of the dead. Someone who conducts your soul upon your death into the underworld.
Because that's what this is, right? The man behind the Winkies is death.
Yes.
And I think we know that because upon seeing him, we go inside the paper bag, and it's the same paper bag that the couple from the airport goes in or comes out of. So maybe this is the issue, is that the disembodied voice can only be the voice of the dead, right?
Right.
And when you come in contact with the source of it, then you die, which is why when the people in Ringu find what's the voice that is on the tape, that's deadly to listen to. When Betty and Rita go and find Diane's corpse, which is really Betty's corpse, and this is there's no one correct interpretation of Mulholland Drive, except for mine, which is that the first half of the movie is the beautiful dream of her life that Diane is having in the last moments of her consciousness.
Yeah. I would tend to agree.
Throughout that dream, there are little phone calls and voices coming through reminding her that it's not real. For example, in her aunt's apartment complex, she has a neighbor who's a little bit crazy, who wanders up to her and says, "Someone's in trouble. Something bad is happening." And Betty's like, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know who you are." And the landlady is like, "Oh, don't mind her. She goes around saying stuff." But these are the voices that are reminding Betty that this is a dream. This is a very rosy veneer on a terrible situation.
Right. And that ultimately,
on the most dire of catastrophes.
That ultimately, none of it is real or tangible.
Mm-hmm.
And that scene at Club Silencio, when the disembodied voices are brought to the forefront and made explicit and made the center of our attention.
They really force you to recognize that the voice does not have a source. The source has collapsed, has disappeared, has abandoned you. And it's traumatic for the characters. They're appalled.
This is the dream collapsing.
Yeah. And it's appalling to the viewer, I think, too. It's appalling to me.
It's
really
painful.
Hard to watch because, as I said, they become emotionally close and you see them make love, and it's like really sweet and tender and innocent. Betty says to Rita, "Have you done this before?" And Rita says, "I don't remember." And then she says, "Have you?" And Betty just says, "I want to with you."
I know, God.
It's a fucking heartbreaker.
It is.
And I think it's so deftly handled too, because Betty is very sweet and very innocent and pretty like non-sexual, but it doesn't feel like it just, it feels very romantic.
It
feels very pure, like maybe that, almost too pure in a way that you hate to see in lesbian sex scenes, but.
No, I like it. And it's because that purity comes through the lens of David Lynch's kind of soapiness, you know, they're throwing each other, they're throwing their bodies at each other, they're gasping and making
there's an
these
earned intimacy.
Yeah, it really is. And it's, I mean, it's crushing.
It really is devastating. And I think if you want to talk about sex scenes that are important to the plot, I would say that is one where
inseparable.
You have to have that for their ultimate schism to land correctly.
Right. Without that, the movie falls apart.
Because in the second half of the film, when you see parts of their relationship, it's, you know, a little bit more complicated, a little more tawdry than as it's portrayed in Diane's dream. And it is unambiguously a sexual relationship between adults. And I think that it's important to specify that Diane's fantasy is not of a pure, innocent relationship of friendship. It's a vision of a relationship that develops in a way without baggage, where they can be on the same side.
Yeah, they have this thing that unites them.
They have this common mission. Camilla needs her in her dream in a way that she never does in reality.
Yeah. And Betty, in fact, has, you know, Camilla's skills and charisma in the dream.
Right.
Which I think speaks to the classic lesbian conundrum, do I want to fuck her or beer?
Yeah, in Diane's dream, where she is Betty, the actress who gets the role that should have been hers is named Camilla.
Mm-hmm.
There's a continual sense that something that should have been was thwarted by circumstances beyond their control, by like gangsters and again this weird cowboy, and like Billy Ray Cyrus is having sex with the director's wife, and
right, it's everything but Zeus reaching down from Olympus.
Mm-hmm. It's everything but Camilla just kind of being bored with Diane,
right,
which is everything clearly the case in reality.
And I think that's something that Lynch does so well, is understanding that a great deal of the conflict we experience as adults is not resolvable to to mutual happiness.
Yeah. He really resists like putting a hat on it, being there's the reason. So good night, everybody. He specializes in problems that can't be solved. And I vibe with that.
It's very refreshing to encounter in fiction.
That's definitely something that I have striven to emulate.
Oh,
my
you
work.
Do that very successfully.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, I know I'm always talking about how much I love Palm Ash, but nothing in Palm Ash could possibly have been like resolved by sitting down to talk about it. Everything is fundamental.
That's because in the way that we talk about conflict resolution interpersonally, when I say we talk, I mean people tweet about mostly, because maybe you're listening to this in the year 1999, but it's March 2021, and we've been in quarantine for a little over a year. So most of our social interactions are happening on social media, which is hellish, of course.
It's fucking terrible.
As I'm sure you people of the future are well aware. But the way that people talk about interpersonal conflict makes it seem like there are very clear rules to things that you should and should not do. If somebody does this, you automatically know that they're a predator, and, you know, this or that thing you must never do. And if you express your needs in the correct way, then the other person will hear and respect and respond to that. And if they don't, then they're a bad person. There's a real desire to simplify human relationships, right and wrong party.
They want
to
solve it like chess.
Yeah.
And you can't. Life is unresolvable. and every human connection is beyond calculation. Even if everything is, you know, fucking psychologically dirt simple, there's no way to avoid hurting each other.
Yeah.
Because it is painful to have an emotional connection to another human being.
Mm-hmm. And because the nature of existence is loss, just continual loss. Everything is entropy. From the moment you're born, you're dying.
We come into existence and then we suffer for our entire lives. And that's, I don't find that to be a nihilistic thing to believe. Well, I mean, it's not even a matter of whether I believe it, it's the truth. To me, being so insignificant and living in such a huge, unbelievable mystery is really awe-inspiring. I think that the state of not understanding is profound if you let yourself occupy it instead of resisting it and trying to retreat further and further into rules, which will inevitably create problems far worse than they prevent.
Well, here's the thing, Gretchen. A lot of people don't like us.
Well, fuck them.
No, I know, right? But like, it might not be the best viewpoint from which to make friends. Although,
we have so many friends.
Yeah, we do. We're very popular. Everyone and we have each other. We have a wonderful friendship. We have a friendship that other people are like, oh, I love how you guys love each other. That's great. What a wonderful thing in life.
It's a thing that means a lot to me.
Yeah, me too. I love you, my brother.
I love you too, Gooch, from bean to bar.
From bean to bar, as per usual. That tweet was deleted. It's like the most heartbreaking thing.
It's such a good tweet.
Because there was, this is a extremely like 2015 issue, that there was some hipster chocolatier from Brooklyn, two brothers with great big beards, which was the style at the time. And that they kept talking about their how they made the chocolate bars bean to bar. And somebody did a great tweet about the two brothers having this conversation that was like, how are the bars? How's the chocolate bean to bar as per usual? I love you, my brother. I love you too, my brother. Which, as you can see, we reference a lot, although the tweet no longer exists except in our memories. I don't think it's even been, it's not one of those tweets that was popular enough to get archived somewhere either. If you have the text of the original I love you, my brother, bean to bar tweet, please get in touch.
Yeah,
is what I'm saying.
I would love to have that.
I think it's funny that you and I relate to each other as brothers. Isn't it?
It is kind of funny, especially because I feel like our relationship has been so stereotypically sisterly in so many ways.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what do I know? I didn't grow up with sisters, but I assume it's like that.
It is. It is.
What I would like it to have been like.
You know, I was at the time that I was growing up with sisters, I was not myself a sister to them.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, it has felt right to me. And whether or not it fits traditional ideas of sisterhood, I don't really care. You know, and in a lot of ways, you were one of the earliest people to whom I looked to see how womanhood was done.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it was very important to me that
I love that
we got to know each other shortly after I came out.
That's really cool. That's, you know, I think about how my mom taught me how to be a woman, and I grew up to be a woman who's very like her in many ways. And the ways that I'm not like her are deliberate and have been difficult for me to do. Like, I had to do them consciously. But a lot of the things that she taught me, most of the things that she taught me, I am grateful for. And I was thinking, I think often that I, you know, I have a son that I gave birth to, and I have a stepdaughter who will probably emulate her mother as she grows up. And my son isn't super interested in, he's pretty gender neutral in his interests and his aesthetics, but like, I don't think he's ever going to want me to teach him to be a girl, you know?
Right.
He's never going to take after me in that way. So it's nice that someone does.
Well, I feel both happy with what I've gotten out of it and proud to carry that part of you forward, even though I'm like a tiny bit younger than you.
Just enough. Just enough that I get to feel a little maternal about you sometimes.
Sometimes.
So do you want to answer some listener questions before we sign off for the night?
All right. This one comes from Quinn HPM. Are you beautiful criers or ugly criers?
Gretchen is a beautiful crier.
Thank you, Julia. I didn't want to be the one to say it, but it's true.
Honest to God. Just like big liquid eyes. Nobody looks sadder than Gretchen. She has an extremely tragic face.
Yeah, my face was just made to be.
You have resting tragedy face.
I do. One time I was crying in therapy and my therapist was like, I don't want to downplay the seriousness of what you're experiencing, but you should know you're a very beautiful crier. You look angelic right now.
What the fuck? Your therapist said that? Oh yeah. My God. Well, that's the ultimate. That's the dream, right?
Exactly. I got an A in therapy. A thing that is both normal to want, impossible to get, in the words of Sarah McHenry.
Perfect.
I know that you don't think of yourself as a beautiful crier, but I think that you look like an English saint from the 1300s who's in her death agonies when she cries. And I think that's exceptionally beautiful.
That's perfect. You know that's good.
I do know it's good. I know
it's a well-crafted compliment for the target audience. I think it's important for Quinn to know that we're both very beautiful criers.
Well, we have so much practice being sad.
That's true.
One time we used that like menthol rub
Okay, so I went to a theatrical makeup shop in Midtown Manhattan, just like to kill some time. And I bought, among other things, that like mentholated stick that you rub around your eyes to make yourself cry if you need to. And I brought it to the crying karaoke, but I don't think it wasn't as effective as we hoped.
That's too bad. It worked well when we used it.
Oh, that's right. Did we put it on to watch a movie?
Yeah. I think it was right after we watched a movie with Sean and you went and got it and said, okay, let's cry.
Yes.
That's extremely me. Quite a bit over.
Yeah,
the years.
Do. We do cry together a lot. That's fine. I think that's good.
Yeah, I do too. That's normal.
For us, it is.
Yeah. Sometimes a bitch has to be sad.
Sad bitches.
Anyway, we are very hot criers.
Yes, absolutely.
This one comes from Ferret Party. Hi, Cassie. What are your thoughts on mellified man?
What is that? I'm from the word, I am assuming that it's a man preserved in honey or turned into honey.
It is I believe a Greek recounting of a supposed Arab tradition in which
sounds
a man,
very legit.
Yeah, it's definitely not real. Just to prefigure this explanation.
Oh, okay.
But the story holds that an Arab man of 70 or 80 who's approaching the end of his life would make a sacrifice of himself to his community by beginning this course of eating in which he consumed only honey until his body began to shut down and he would even begin to excrete honey. It's all fake. And then when he died, he would be placed in a coffin full of honey and the coffin would be sealed for 100 years. And then once 100 years had passed, the seals would be struck off and you would remove the resultant flesh and it would be like a panacea that could cure any wound or illness.
I definitely have read about this before.
That was a mellified man. And it's, I guess my opinion on it is just that it's not real.
My opinion is that it's delicious.
It probably would be.
Hmm.
I really like honey.
Yeah. I'm fine with it.
All right, what do you think? One more before we sign off?
Sure. Here's the thing, is that sometimes we try to stop recording right around an hour, but then I have to cut out like at least 10 minutes of ums. which is why the podcast always only comes to 50 minutes. So we can go a little over.
Yeah, let's go a little longer. All right. This one comes from Eve Harms Writes. Are there any films or television shows in the comedy genre that you find transcendent?
No.
Yeah, it's a no for me too. Comedy is just not something that speaks to me in the way that drama does. I'm fundamentally sort of less interested in comedy because it seldom involves real people. As you know, its characters are like, I'm borrowing a term from Julia's partner and my good friend, Sean Collins, they're joke delivery machines.
Yeah.
Certainly in that's true in the case of sitcoms, which I largely really dislike and don't think anything of.
We like comedy movies. I don't think of it as transcendental really though.
No. I think Frasier's pretty firmly confined within the earthly plane.
He's venal as hell.
Yeah, he's incredibly venal, and so is the show. And I sort of think that comedy has to be venal to be good.
Mm.
Because what I like is comedy that is mean-spirited and at someone's expense, typically.
Yeah, like, my favorite jokes are always the ones that are a little sad, or maybe mostly sad with a little bit of a joke in it.
Right, like you love Wonder Showzen.
Oh, I fucking love Wonder Showzen. Okay. No, you're right. Because Wonder Showzen is a comedy show. Ostensibly. That's my answer. It's not... Was the question a film? It's not a film. But Wonder Showzen is a top five media to me.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to eat crow too on this one.
Oh, shit.
Tim and Eric's Bedtime Stories.
Oh, sure. Yeah, Tim and Eric is pretty great.
Yeah.
But those are like, this is very dark comedy.
Right. Like pitch black, like, you know, autopsying a guy with a belly full of toes is the joke.
Oh my God. Like, okay, so my favorite joke from Wonder Showzen is the one where Wonder Showzen is very arty kind of comedy show that is, it looks like a kid's show. But with very bleak humor, you know, they've got like, it's like a Sesame Street kind of a thing, which sounds like shit, right? Like, I agree. Like, Avenue Q, I've never seen that. I haven't heard a word of it. It looks like probably my least favorite thing that has ever existed. This is not like that. There's like little animated segments and there's these like kind of puppet characters that do stuff. So there's an episode where they have a science fair and... they're each showing their science projects, and the girl Muppet, or it's not really a Muppet, it's just a puppet, it's like a hand puppet, but, you know, she's the pink one, because it's also a parody of these things. She says, I made a hat that's powered by sadness, and it's like one of those propeller beanies, and she puts it on, and then she just flies away. and then later in the show you see her and she's like, oh no, I'm sinking, and then a seagull comes up and shows her a bunch of pictures of clubbed baby seals and she's like, thanks, and then she like flies off again. oh my God,
that's
really very fucking funny to me.
That's like a pretty good metaphor for either of our careers.
I know. I think about that all the time. Like, I look at my job that I made for myself, and I'm like, oh, I made a hat that's powered by sadness.
Yeah.
That really is my fucking job. I bet if you search that, then you will find that I have twoed about it. Wonder Showzen is, like, just transcendental in its awfulness.
It kind of shares a thread with Tim and Eric, which is that it's uniquely about like this sort of very American grotesquerie.
Uh-huh. Well, they're both affectionate eviscerations of certain types of trashy media.
Right.
In Wonder Showzen, you know, there's cartoons that are they sort of seem like they might be educational, and then the they're followed to some absurd conclusion. Or, but you know, Tim and Eric also has the, like, it wouldn't work if it wasn't so clear that there is an underlying, not affection, but the contempt that only comes from familiarity.
Yes, that is exactly it.
It's like the kind of hatred that you can only feel for a member of your family.
And I think that sincerity is what makes bedtime stories so good. Like, it takes these absurd characters and situations and it plays them so straight. My favorite episode is called Sauce Boy.
Tell me about Sauce Boy.
So in it, Eric Wareheim plays, I can't remember his name, but he is introduced at like a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, and he goes up and he starts to give his speech. And as he continues, you realize that actually what he and everyone in this room are addicted to is eating dirty diapers.
Oh my God.
And after the meeting, he's accosted by a mobster, Bobby Baloney, played by Tim Heidecker, who takes him to a cafe and gives him a cure for his dirty diaper addiction, and then reveals that he's now going to be the mob's new sauce boy, and he's going to like come and sweep up their hangout and make the red sauce for the evening pasta. And it's just like this incredible emotional odyssey about the dumbest things you can imagine. Just, it's so fucking stupid, but every beat of it is handled with such care. It's even shot beautifully. It looks every bit as good as some of the very best mafia fiction. And I think it's that craftsmanship and that understanding of how stupid the underpinnings of American culture are. How petty and small the things that move us are, you know, that's what makes both Wonder Shows and Bedtime Stories.
Right. That's like, that's the joke. That's the backbone of a lot of Wonder Shows and jokes, is that there are certain things in the film toolbox that people go to again and again because they're effective. And those, there's a certain type of visual language that is used so often that it becomes kind of, you feel the feelings whether or not the content is there. Does that make sense?
Yes.
You know, for example, like there's a famous like Wonder Shows and where they do a, they have like little kids dancing and singing this like exciting song, and the song's about slaves. Except is celebrating like slaves built the pyramids, slaves built the Parthenon, like all the accomplishments of slaves. And this is very grim humor, obviously. It is not much on the face of it, but then also like we live in a world where we still have slaves in the United States. We have massive incarcerated population that is forced to work for free. And the way that we talk about them is really dehumanizing. And we, even if we are trying to, this is probably not a topic that I should get into at this point in the night when I have been drinking, to say something stupid. The point is just that
the show
they have in the toolbox to make it sound good,
right.
And can trick you into thinking that it's great, in the same way that there can be like an inspirational article about how like a 6-year-old sold a kidney to save their granddad dying from cancer. Like,
right. It's exactly like that.
The morbid way that the jargon of inspiration is used to manipulate us into celebrating despicable things. Oh no. Did somebody get sad?
Get? No. Remain? Yes.
You've been in the Sadness Amplifier with Julia Graffair
and Gretchen Felker Martin.
You can follow us on a lot of different platforms. I believe we're on iTunes now, which is cool. So rate and review us on iTunes.
Hell yeah.
Which I don't know that that's important, but I've heard other podcasters say it, so it seems like it must be really important. So, oh, I know what I wanted to say to you. So many things. There's another podcast called The Lament Configuration. Did you know that?
Damn, what?
When I went to subscribe to us on iTunes, I saw this. I didn't go listen to the podcast or find out what it's about because I thought that would be collusion.
Well, we should see if it's ongoing and maybe talk to the people who run it.
I don't know what we do about that. So sorry to the other Lament Configuration podcast, but
no relation.
No relation. No reference. You can listen to us on Breaker, Google Podcasts, Pocket Cast, Radio Public, Spotify, or copy RSS, or on iTunes, or at anchor.fm/lament-configuration.
And on SoundCloud.
Oh yeah, on SoundCloud. I'm sorry.
That's no problem. I'm also a little drunk.
Yeah, that's fine. I heard that's entertaining.
I mean, I drank
two beers and one coffee, which is like the podcast serum.
Yeah, that seems right.
But I'm still going to say goodnight because I don't want to edit a podcast that's any longer than this.
That sounds right.
I love you, my brother.
I love you too. From bean to bar, as per usual.
As per usual.